Hare Krishna. Welcome to our Saturday Bhagavad Gita class. We have finished the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita last time, and from today we are beginning the second chapter. The second chapter is quite long. It has 72 verses. So we will divide the second chapter into two parts. The first 39 verses will be the first part, and we will keep on chanting the first half of the second chapter till we come to verse 39 in our discussion, and then we will go on to part 2. Now, as we chant these verses, please remember that there are some verses here which we will chant in a slightly different meter, specifically verses 5 to 8 and then text 20, 22 and so on. So as we go along in the chanting, and if you chant with me, then you will be able to follow. And in text 9 there is a small printing error. Evam uktva rishikesham. It is gudakeshah, not kudakeshah. So just a small printing error. So we will chant now.
Atha dvitiyodhyayah Sanjaya uvacha Tam tatha kripaya vishtam Ashru purna kulekshanam Vishidantam idam vakyam Uvacha madhusudanah Shri Bhagavan uvacha Kutastvakashmalamidam Vishame samupasthitam Anaryajushtam asvargyam Akirtir karamarjuna Klaibhyam masmagamah partha Naitatvayupapadyate Kshudram hridaya daurbalyam Tyaktvotishtha parantapa Arjuna uvacha Katham bhishmamaham sankhye Dronam cha madhusudana Ishubhi pratiyotsyami Pujarha varisudana Guru nahatvahinahanubhavan Shreyo bhoktum bhaiksham apihaloke Hatvartha kamanstu guruni haiva Bhunjiya bhogan rudhira pradigdhan Na chaita vidmaha katarano gariyo Yadva jayema yadivana jayaye Yane vahatvana jujivi visham Sveta svitaha dhartra rashtraha Karpanya dosho pahata svabhavaha Prichamitvam dharma sammoodha cheta Yachreyasyanishchitam bruhitanme Shishyastiham shadhimam tvam prapannam Nahi prapashyami mama punvadyad Yachokum uchpashyantikam Rajam Suranam Apichadipatyam Sanjaya Uvacha Eva Muktvarishikesham Gudakeshah Parantapaha Nayotsya Iti Govindam Uktvatushnim Babhuvaha Tamuvacha Rishikesham Prahasanniva Bharata Sena yoru bhayor madhye Vishidantam idam vachah Shri Bhagavan uvacha Ashochanan vashochastvam Prajnavadamsya bhashase Gatasuna gatasunsya Nanushochanti pandita Natve vaham jatunasam Natvam ne me janadhipa, na chaiva na bhavishyamaha, sarve vayamatah param, dehi nosmin yatha dehe, kaumaram yauvanam jara, tatha dehantara prapti, dhirastatra namuhyati, matra sparshastu kaunteya, Shitoshna sukha dukkhada agamapaino nitya stam stitikshasva bharata yam hi navyathayantyete purusham purusharshabha samadukha sukham dhiram somritatvaya kalpate nasato vidyate bhavo Na bhavo vidyate sataha ubhayorapi drishtonta stvanayostatva darshibhihi avinashitu tadvidhi yena sarvamidam tatam vinashamavyayasyasya na kaschit kartum arhati antavanta ime deha Nityasyoktah sharirinah anashino prameyasya tasmad yudhyasva bharata ya enam veti hantaram yaschainam manyate hatam ubhautau na vijanito nayam hanti na hanyate Na jayate mriyate va kadachin nayam bhutva bhavita vana bhuyaha ajo nityah shashvato yam purano na hanyate hanyamane sharire veda rashinam nityam ya enam janavyayam katham sa purushah partha Kam ghatayati hantikam vasamsi jirnani yatha vihaya navani grihnati naroparani tatha sharirani vihaya jirnan anyani sanyati navani dehi nainam chindanti shastrani nainam dahati pavakaha Na chainam kledayantyapo, na shoshayati marutaha, achedyoyam adahyoyam, akledyo shosha evacha, nityah sarvagata sthanur, achaloyam sanatanaha, avyaktoyam achintyoyam, avikaryoyam uchyate, Tasmadevam viditvainam nanushochitum arhasi atha chainam nitya jatam nityam vamanyase mritam tathapi tvam mahabaho nainam shochitum arhasi jatasya hi dhruvo mrityur dhruvam janma mritasya cha Tasmada pariharyerthe natvam shochitum arhasi avyaktadini bhutani avyaktam adhyane bharata avyaktani dhananyeva tatra ka paridevana ascharya tatshyati kaschidena ascharya vatvadati tathaiva chanyaha Ascharya vachaina manya shrinoti shrutvapyenam vedana chaiva kaschit dehi nityam avadhyoyam dehi sarvasya bharata tasmat sarvani bhutani natvam shochitum arhasi svadharmam apichaveksha Na vikampitu varhasi dharmyadhi yuddha shreyonyat kshatriyasya na vidyate yadrichhaya chopapannam Svargadvaram apavritam sukhinah kshatriyah partha labhante yuddhimidrisham atha chetvam imam dharmyam sangramam na karishyasi tatah svadharma kirtim cha hitva papam avapsyasi akirtim chapi bhutani kathayishyanti te vyayam sambhavatisya chakirtir maranaditi richyate bhayadrana mansyante tvam maharatha yesham cha tvam bahumato utva vyasya silam Nindanstasva samartham to da dukkhataram nukim hato va prapsyasi svargyam jitva va bhokshase mahim tasmad uttishtha kaunteya yuddhaya kritinashchayah sukha dukkhe same kritva labha labho jaya jayo Tato yuddhaya yujyasva naivam papam avapsyasi esha te bhita sankhye buddhir yoge tvimam shrinu buddhya yukto yaya partha karma bandhan prahasyasi hare krishna 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 hare 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 Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna. So far we have been seeing the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Now we are beginning the second chapter. The first chapter has ended with Arjun putting down his weapons. Visrijya sasharam chapam shokasam vidna manasaha. He has put down his bow and arrow, and his mind full of lamentation, he has given up his weapons, and he wishes to take up the path of non-violence. This second chapter is called Sankhya Yoga. It is essentially the summary of the entire Bhagavad Gita. It is called Sankhya Yoga because in this chapter, Arjuna is going to hear from Krishna a wonderful explanation of the difference between spirit and matter. Sankhya means analysis, comes from Sankhya or counting. So when we analyze the difference between matter and spirit, that is called Sankhya Yoga. So Krishna is going to explain in detail as we go along in this chapter the details of what is matter and what is spirit, particularly about the spirit. And this is the chapter for the first time in which Krishna is going to take on the position of a guru. And this is also the chapter in which the first time Krishna is going to begin speaking. Thus far it was only Arjuna speaking. And soon we are going to see Krishna also beginning his discourse. In the second chapter there are 72 verses, quite a long chapter. But since we have divided the second chapter into two parts, texts 1 to 39 and 40 to 72, we will discuss for the first few weeks only the first part. The first three verses sees Krishna reprimanding or scolding Arjuna for his weakness, for not wanting to fight. The next few verses, 4 to 9, Arjuna will continue from this first chapter and discuss further reasons for not wanting to fight. Arjuna has not finished with his reasons. Text 10 to 30 will be that section of the chapter where the main teachings of Sankhya Yoga will come, where Krishna will discuss the Atma and the qualities. And then subsequently from 31 to 39, Krishna will induce Arjun to fight, because it is a Kshatriya's dharma to fight when dharma so demands. Now, second chapter is very important. It is a very basic chapter. In this chapter, many of the basic concepts of the Gita are included. So therefore, it is very important to understand this second chapter, especially as we go along. And once we have understood second chapter, then we have understood more or less what the whole Gita is. Last time, we saw the glories of the first chapter as given in the Padma Puran, in the Gita Mahatmya. The Gita Mahatmya is that section of the Padma Puran where Lord Shiva is glorifying to Parvati Devi the glories of Bhagavad Gita upon being so questioned by Parvati Devi. As the conversation continues, Lord Shiva has been explaining to Parvati the conversation that took place between Lord Vishnu and Lakshmi Devi. And in that way, he had explained the glories of the first chapter. Now, Parvati Devi wants to hear from Lord Shiva the glories of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So, Lord Shiva begins to quote from Lord Vishnu's speech to Lakshmi Devi. So, Lord Vishnu says, "Very long ago, there was a Brahman, very learned, very righteous and virtuous, whose name was Devashyam, and he lived in Pandharpur," same Pandharpur, "and he used to perform all the fire sacrifices very regularly. He was very careful to receive guests very attentively, and he pleased all the demigods and the Supreme Lord by performing various kinds of religious activities. These are all part of dharma. Any pious householder must do these things. There must always be yajna, dan and tapa in anybody's home. In fact, in any ashram, whether one is a grihastha or a sannyasi or a brahmachari or a vanaprasthi, yajna, dan and tapa are necessary. The form of the yajna, dan and tapa may change according to the circumstances. For example, the tapasya that a sannyasi or a vanaprastha staying in the forest will do may be different from the tapasya that a householder is expected to do at home. But nevertheless, the principle of tapasya or simple living, accepting a little bit of difficulty in life, following certain regulative principles, which may be difficult for the body or mind to accept, must be done." So this Brahman was religiously following all these particular regulative principles. And he was very eager to understand the relationship between the soul and the super soul, Atma and Paramatma. And therefore he was always meeting various kinds of yogis and tapasvis and all kinds of sadhus in his search to find out the absolute truth. In this way, many years passed. One day, as he was walking, he came across a yogi. This yogi was full in knowledge of Lord Krishna within his heart, but he had accepted the path of Ashtanga Yoga. Therefore, he was sitting in a meditative posture, and his eyes were half closed and looking at the tip of his nose, the practice that is described by Lord Krishna in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and that is followed by the Ashtanga Yogis who live in the Himalayas. So immediately, he was attracted to this yogi because the yogi looked so peaceful and calm and complete. He waited for some time and then he asked the yogi, "Please explain to me how I can obtain complete peace of mind. How can I obtain complete and pure knowledge?" So the yogi replied, "Go to Sopur. In Sopur, there is a goat herdsman, a man who looks after goats, that is his profession, and his name is Mitravan. So he will instruct you in the science of self-realization." So, Devashyam thought it a little strange that he should go and accept instructions in self-realization from a man whose profession was herding goats. But nevertheless, he went to Sopur. And on the northern side, as his inquiries indicated, he went near the banks of the river and saw a very beautiful spot near the forest. And there upon some rocks, he saw this person, Mitravan. The scene was very beautiful. Gentle breeze was blowing. The aroma of the forest flowers was coming. It was a captivating sight. And there was Mitravan seated on top of the rocks, completely wrapped in meditation, with a very blissful and peaceful look upon his face. And when Devashyam looked around, he was astonished, because he saw that everything was so calm and peaceful that the goats, not only were they wandering around very nicely, but they were sitting next to the tigers, and the tigers were not eating them. So the tigers and the goats were moving around together as friends. So then Devashyam was very surprised to see this. And he went and sat next to Mitravan. He waited for Mitravan's meditation to break. And then he asked Mitravan that, "I have come here to your shelter to learn the science of devotion to Lord Krishna. So please explain to me, how can one become a great devotee of the Lord? And please explain to me how you have achieved this position. And please explain to me how all this has happened that I see in front of me," indicating the cow, that the goats and the tigers were sitting together. So Mitravan said, "My dear Devashyam, I will tell you a story as it happened long ago. Many years ago, I was here herding goats. And all of a sudden, a tiger jumped out from the forest. And when we saw the tiger, all of us ran helter-skelter. The goats and myself, all of us ran away in great fear. And as I was running into the forest and I looked around, I saw a very amazing sight. I saw that the tiger had caught up with one goat, but the moment he reached the goat, immediately he became like a lamb, like a goat himself. And as I was witnessing, the goat was also surprised to see that the tiger was not pouncing on him. So the goat asked the tiger, 'My dear tiger, you have come so close to me, and very easily you could finish me and kill me and eat me, yet you do not jump on me and kill me and eat my flesh. Why is this? This is very, very surprising indeed.' So the tiger said, 'I do not know. I am suddenly feeling a sense of so much peace and happiness. I am feeling so non-violent, and all my hunger and thirst has vanished. I feel no desire to commit any violence.' And the goat also said, and the tiger asked the goat, 'What makes you stand here so fearless in front of me instead of running away?' So the goat replied, 'I don't know. I am also surprisingly feeling so fearless and peaceful that even though my mortal enemy is standing in front of me, nothing is happening to me. I am completely calm.' So then they discussed among themselves. They tried to analyze the whole issue, but could not come to any conclusion. So they said, 'Yonder sits this man there, Mitravan. Let us go and ask him.' So they came to Mitravan to ask him the question. So Mitravan said, 'I do not know. Let us go and ask that monkey king who is on the branch of the tree.' So they went to the monkey and asked him, 'My dear monkey king, do you know the secret of all that is happening here today?' So the monkey explained, 'Yes. It is an old story. In this forest, there is a temple of Lord Shiva. And the creator of this universe, Brahma, has himself installed a Shivalinga there. And many, many years ago, a great sage called Sukama used to live here. He was very desirous of attaining pure devotion to Lord Krishna. And for this purpose, he came here into this forest. And he was performing all kinds of penances and austerities. So as he was here serving very nicely, offering water to Shivalinga and performing other forms of worship, performing meditation, austerities, prayers, one day a sage came to visit him. And Sukam served the sage very nicely. He got him some fruits and roots and water from the forest, fed him nicely. And after the sage had eaten and rested, then he began to talk with Sukam. And the sage asked Sukam, "What is it that you desire?" Sukam said, "I only desire pure devotion to Lord Krishna. That is my only objective in life, and that is why I have come here into this forest. So please tell me the way by which I can obtain pure devotion to the Lord." So at that time, this sage wrote down the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita on stones. He carved them out on the stones and instructed Sukam, "Please read this attentively with faith and devotion every day." And then the sage disappeared. Then Sukam continued to chant the verses that were written down on the rock by that sage, and very soon he became free from hunger and thirst, and a great sense of peace and joy dawned upon Sukam, and he attained loving devotion to Lord Krishna. Then the monkey began to explain that it is since that time that this whole area near this side has become an area of peace due to the influence of that great sage and Rishi Sukam. So anyone who comes here, immediately they become free from hunger and thirst and lamentation, and they also develop devotion for the Lord. So then Mitravan, that goat, and the tiger, they all went. In fact, even Devasham. So they all went to the forest and they chanted, and they also achieved the same result. And Mitravan narrated this whole story to Devasham and instructed him that you also please go there and read these verses with an attentive heart, and you will also attain the same destination. And then Lord Vishnu concluded his story to Lakshmi Devi and said, "So my dear Lakshmi Devi, this is the glory of the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The one who attains this or reads this and studies this very regularly with a faithful heart, devoted heart, will attain devotion to the Lord and freedom from all the dualities of material existence." So therefore, we should also study the second chapter very attentively. We should read it very carefully with faith. In fact, the same principle should apply to every single chapter of Bhagavad Gita that we study. Because every chapter has its own glories, its own mahatmya. So these are not fairy tales. These are all stories from the Puranas, which are actually histories of bygone ages. And they are reproduced by the great sages just for our benefit. We have no knowledge of any history more than a few thousand years. But the sages who compiled the Puranas and Upanishads had accounts of histories that go back many, many millions of years, not just a few thousand years. So by hearing these stories or these histories, we gain deeper appreciation of the value of what we are reading and studying and hearing. So now, with this brief background, let us begin the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So kindly open your books. We are now on the first chapter, second chapter, first verse.
Sanjaya uvacha tam tatha kripaya vishtam ashrupurna kulekshanam vishidantamidam vakyam uvacha madhusudanaha.
Translation. Sanjay said, seeing Arjun full of compassion, his mind depressed, his eyes full of tears, Madhusudan, Krishna, spoke the following words. Sanjay knew the mind of Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra was so attached to his son and his sons, in fact, that even though he knew the Pandavas were righteous and virtuous and they deserved to rule the kingdom, still he hoped that his sons would emerge victorious. At the end of the first chapter, Sanjay had described how Arjuna had put down his weapons with a desire to adopt the path of non-violence. So this internally pleased Dhritarashtra, because he thought, I hope this dharma vritti becomes stronger in Arjuna's heart, this religious tendency, because if he does so and develops this higher dharma, ahimsa paramo dharmo, then what will happen? Then the battle will not take place, and then as it is my sons are ruling the kingdom, it will continue to be theirs and there will be no obstacle. So Sanjay, being very fine in his intelligence, understood Dhritarashtra's mentality. So immediately he dashed his hopes and his wishful thinking by using the word Madhusudana. Madhusudana is another name of Krishna, as we have seen, the killer of the demon Madhu. So Sanjay is indicating that, my dear Dhritarashtra, Krishna is the killer of Madhu, and now Krishna will kill the demons of doubts that have arisen in Arjuna's mind, and Arjuna will be re-energized once again to fight the battle. So do not be under illusion or under false hopes, thinking that because Arjuna is lamenting, he is in grief now, that he is going to give up the war. No, very soon he will come back. So this is how the Acharyas explain the purport of why Sanjay uses the word Madhusudan here. And actually, Arjun is very keen on fighting, was very keen on fighting, till such time as he actually came face to face with his relatives. When he actually began to see that he was going to kill all his enemies, or all his relatives, his heart wavered. He wants to tell Krishna that you are Madhusudan, you killed Madhu, the demon, who was your enemy, but I am supposed to kill my relatives. It's a different story altogether. And therefore, he came under illusion. What was his illusion? His illusion was due to bodily identification. Bodily identification is an illusion like a dream. Like in a dream, we sometimes think that we are being chased by a tiger, or we think that our head has been cut off, but actually neither is there any tiger, and our head is still very much on our shoulders. But the illusion in the dream is so powerful that we start crying in the dream or lamenting, oh, my head has gone, or a tiger is chasing me. So bodily attachment and lamentation is such a kind of illusion. All lamentation, grief, illusion simply comes from bodily attachment, and all this is simply like a dream. And this dream causes great suffering. So what is the suffering that is being caused to Arjun? Vishidantam idam vakyam. With great lamentation. And what was his condition? Ashrupurna kulekshanam. Ikshanam means eyes. So his eyes were flowing with tears. Here is a very powerful warrior, one of the greatest warriors on the whole earth, and here he is crying, tears flowing from his eyes, all because of bodily attachment. And not only that, tam tatha kripaya vishtam. Sanjay describes that at this stage, Arjun avishtam was overwhelmed with kripa, compassion. He was feeling compassion for his relatives, because he understood that now I will have to kill all my relatives. So this kind of compassion that Arjuna is feeling is actually compassion in ignorance, because it is compassion on the bodily platform. It is compassion for the outward dress of the body. Such compassion has no meaning in spiritual life. In this material world, no one really knows where compassion should be applied. What is true compassion?
Srila Prabhupada narrated a story in this connection that one time a man was drowning in a river and several people gathered onto the shore and none of them knew how to swim. Finally, one of them who knew how to swim, he jumped into the river, swam up to that man who was drowning, and he came back and said, "I have saved him, I have saved him." And when the people saw what it was that this man had saved, they saw it was only the coat. He had only brought the coat of the man and said, "I have saved him, I have saved him." So everybody said, "You have only saved the coat, but the man has drowned. So what is the value of your saving him? What is the value of your jumping in the river?" So similarly, Prabhupada explained, this body is like a dress or like a coat. We will see this more as we go along later on in the second chapter. And the Atma is being covered by this coat of the material body. In material consciousness, when we are devoid of spiritual knowledge, then our compassion is applied simply to the outward dress of the body. We only have material compassion. But real compassion means compassion for the soul. Compassion based upon true understanding of one's real self. That is real compassion. Compassion, if it is based on ignorance and sentimentality, it can even be harmful. For example, if there is a beggar who comes and approaches you for some money to buy some tobacco or for some other sinful activity, and you feel compassion upon him and give him some money, then what will happen? It is misplaced compassion. It is compassion that will create difficulty for him as well as for you. You will also be implicated in that same action, in that same sin. So people generally do not understand the implications of showing compassion to others because they don't know what is real compassion. Everybody is simply thinking on the bodily platform. This material world is compared to an ocean. It is an ocean of birth and death in which everybody is floating. All the 84 lakh species of life, the different living beings are all being tossed about in the very high and turbulent waves of this ocean. So this material world is sometimes called Bhava Sagar. Bhava Sagar means ocean, and Bhava means to become. To become what? To become old, to become diseased, to become dead, to become born once again, to become again and again and again. That is Bhava. And Bhava Sagar means the ocean of birth and death. So a person who is drowning in the ocean of birth and death cannot be saved if you jump in and save only the coat, that is, only his body. All the welfare works that are being done in the world today are simply based on the platform of the body. Even most religious institutions, most so-called charitable institutions, their charity, their compassion is directed only to the dress of the body. Nobody is looking at the soul. And therefore, the very popular opinion amongst people is that charity or compassion for the body is real religious work, is real charity, is real compassion. But this is not true. Such compassion is only temporary. It can last only for a short while. We do not say that one should not offer any services for the help of the body when the body is in trouble. But at the same time, we should not go to the extreme of understanding that by looking after the needs of the body, we will make somebody happy. It is not possible. It is misplaced compassion. Srila Prabhupada explains here very nicely that no one really knows where compassion should be applied. Compassion for the dress of a drowning man is senseless. One who does not know this and laments for the outward dress is called a Shudra, or one who laments unnecessarily. So the characteristic of a learned person is that he or she doesn't lament unnecessarily. No grieving, no unnecessary grief about something. So therefore, Arjun, being a Kshatriya, should have understood better. He should have known something about the soul, the difference between the soul and the body. But he was lamenting like an ordinary ignorant man, like a Shudra. And Arjuna was very dear to Krishna. So Krishna is thinking that Arjuna is my very dear friend, he is my cousin, he is my great devotee, and he has been attacked by a demon. I should save him now. My name is Madhusudan. Who is the demon that has attacked Arjuna at this time? The demon of forgetfulness. The demon of forgetfulness of one's identity, of one's real position as spirit soul, as distinct from this material body. So Krishna thinks, now I have to save my devotee. He is being attacked. And what is the way to save my devotee from this demon? It is to give him knowledge. So now, for the first time in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is going to switch his mode. Arjuna will move into a different gear now. Or rather, Krishna is moving into a different gear. Krishna will start scolding Arjuna. So what is Krishna's reprimand for Arjuna? Let us see in the second verse. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Kutasvakasmalamidam Vishame Samupasthitam Anarya Jushtamasvargyam Akirti Karam Arjuna. Translation: the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, how have these impurities come upon you? They are not at all befitting a man who knows the value of life. They lead not to higher planets, but to infamy." So again, for the first time, when Krishna speaks, we hear his introduction as given by Sanjay. When somebody is about to give a lecture, he is introduced. He is so, Mr. So-and-so, he is going to speak to you now. So Sanjay is introducing the speaker, Krishna, to Dhritarashtra. And what is he saying? Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. So right from the beginning, when Krishna speaks, it is being made clear that Krishna is Bhagavan. Bhagavat. That is the meaning of Bhagavan. Bhaga means opulence. Vat means one who possesses. Aishwaryasya samagrasya viryasya yasha shahasriya jnanam vairagayoschaiva sannam bhaga itingana. Parashar Muni has described what is the meaning of this word Bhagavan. Bhagavan means he who possesses all bhaga, all opulences. And primarily there are six kind of opulences that anybody can have. That is wealth, beauty, knowledge, fame, renunciation. Now these qualities are to be found in perfection in Krishna. They are found in very minuscule quantities in living beings in this creation. But Krishna has all these qualities unlimitedly, in perfection at all times. Therefore he is called Bhagavan. It is not that we should address anybody and everybody as Bhagavan. Nowadays it is unfortunate that if someone develops even little bit of mystic powers or siddhis or has some special ability to do something, he is called Bhagavan by his followers. And the sadhu or the mystic yogi accepts that particular appellation or that term and doesn't protest. There is one such Bhagavan in India, and when somebody asked him, when some of our devotees had gone and they asked him that, "Why do you call yourself Bhagavan? Are you God?" He said, "No, my followers call me God. They call me Bhagavan." But that is not an answer. If the followers are calling you Bhagavan, then you can very easily tell them not to call you Bhagavan, because you are not Bhagavan. One time when Srila Prabhupada was in the Western countries, some of his new disciples, who were not knowing the philosophy very well, started to address Srila Prabhupada also as Bhagavan. Prabhupada, and this was done by somebody who had taken sannyas. So Prabhupada became so angry that he actually removed this sannyasi from the mission. He said, you will cause havoc in the society if you start doing this.
He removed him from the ISKCON mission. Of course, later on he repented and came back and begged forgiveness, but that is another thing. But in good faith even, it is not that he meant anything wrong, but he was propagating this kind of philosophy, which infuriated Prabhupada. He said, the problem today is that people are propagating this kind of view, and that is why there is so much confusion. People do not understand Krishna. And anyone who comes along with a little bit of power, he is addressed as Bhagavan. Bhagavan this, Bhagavan that. And those who are called Bhagavan also do not protest. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is directly Krishna himself, who incarnated 500 years ago. And he was playing the part of a devotee. And even though he is God himself, whenever somebody addressed him as God, he would close his ears and say, Vishnu, Vishnu, don't commit such offense. Don't commit such blasphemy. I am only a simple devotee of the Lord. Because he was playing the part of the Lord. So even though the Lord himself comes down, sometimes when he plays the part of a devotee, he also protests when somebody calls him Bhagavan. So therefore one should be very careful and not call anybody and everybody as Bhagavan. Bhagavan is defined in the Shastra. Just like President, Prime Minister, they are defined in the constitution of the country. Who is the Prime Minister, who is the President, how to elect him, and so on. Of course, Bhagavan can never be elected. He can never be nominated or selected by popular vote. Bhagavan is always Bhagavan. He was always Bhagavan, he is Bhagavan, and he always will be Bhagavan. So there is no question of Bhagavan being a post. Even the Devis and Devatas, the demigods, it is a post. Ganesh, Surya, Indra, Brahma, Vayu, Varuna, Durga, these are all posts. These posts are occupied by suitable souls, by suitable jivas, who have performed sufficient amount of pious activity, punya. And they are elevated to that particular position. And they play the role of Varuna Dev or Vayu Dev or Indra Dev or Brahmaji and so on. But these posts will be vacated. Kshine punya marti lokam vishanti. When the punya of that particular jiva is exhausted, they will fall down again to their earlier position on the earth. They will no longer be a demigod. All of us have been traveling in this material world from time immemorial, millions of lifetimes. Who knows how many times each of us has also been Indra or Varun, Vayu? We don't know. Maybe some of you sitting here were in some previous life Indra also. It is possible. Maybe somebody was Surya Dev in some previous life. But after we exhaust the punya, we come down to earth and then everything is forgotten. And when we come down and come into the same society as human beings, if you have come down from position of Surya Dev and I have come up from the position of cat or dog, once I am back in the human form, it doesn't make a difference. We are again human beings once again. So all other positions in creation are simply posts. But Bhagavan is not a post. It is an eternal situation. So Lord Krishna is eternally Bhagavan. So Sanjay is making it very clear right from beginning. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Krishna personally is a source of all the Devis and Devatas. He is even the source of Narayan and Vishnu. Although the popular conception is that Krishna comes from Vishnu, but the truth is that actually Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ete chansa kalaha punsa krishnastu bhagavan swayam indrari vyakulam lokam mridayanti yuge yuge. In the Srimad Bhagavatam it is described that all the other incarnations of the Lord are either directly parts of the Supreme Lord Krishna or parts of his parts. Expansions or expansions of the expansions of Krishna. But Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan. He is the personal, original Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore, Sanjay is declaring very clearly now, here is the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, standing right here. And Krishna is thinking, I am the Supreme Personality of Godhead. My dear devotee and friend is Arjun. And Arjun is under such illusion? How can that be? So immediately he begins to chastise. So Krishna is thinking, Arjuna is my friend. Therefore, how is it that he is under illusion? So he begins by saying, Kutastva, where from? Kutaha means from where, whence? Kashmalam idam, Kashmalam means impurity, some delusion, some wrong notions. So immediately he is asking, Kutastva Kashmalam idam, my dear Arjuna, you are my devotee, you are my friend, I am the supreme original personality of Godhead, and you have been with me, eternally traveling life after life with me. Kutastva Kashmalam idam, how is it that these impurities have come upon you? You are not an ordinary person of this world, but still you are under illusion. How is that possible? And Vishame Samupasthitam, at this very critical hour of the battle, when you should be fighting, what are you doing? Anarya Jushtam. You are speaking like someone who is not an Aryan. There are two words, Arya and Anarya. Arya, you have commonly heard it as Aryan, Aryan civilization. So Aryan means a truly civilized person, one who is born and brought up in spiritual culture. Aryan society means that society that is based upon the principle of spiritual realization, on God realization. Any society that runs on this principle is called an Aryan society. But this word is much misunderstood. Again, in the bodily concept of life, people think that Aryan me is a matter of race, jati, caste. Do you know the most famous person or infamous person in recent history who was under this misconception? Hitler. You have all heard of Hitler, isn't it? So Hitler was thinking the Germans are the original Aryans. They are the true blooded Aryans. And therefore, he killed all those whom he thought were less than Aryans, particularly the Jews. And the Germans at that time, by the propaganda, the powerful Shakti that Hitler had, the propaganda was so powerful that they all began to think, the Germans, that we are Aryans and we are superior to the rest of the world. And so this whole concept, fascist philosophy, came up with Hitler. So Hitler was thinking in terms of Aryan as a bodily concept. Somebody who is born in a particular caste or community or a country is Aryan. But that is not really Aryan. Arya or Anarya depends on one's level of spiritual understanding. Today, most of the world is Anarya. Because one who doesn't understand spiritual principles is Anarya. India originally was called Bharatvarsha. Actually, not only India, the whole planet Earth was called Bharatvarsha. It is only as time went on that Bharatvarsha, the word Bharatvarsha began to refer only to India, Bharat. From Bharatvarsha it became Bharat and many other things after that. And then America, Europe, Australia, Africa, they all began to be called different things because the same Arya culture could not be maintained in all these different continents due to distance. But originally the entire planet had Aryan civilization. It had Aryan culture. Aryan culture means Varnashram Dharma, Sanatan Dharma, based upon our Upanishads and Puranas. And gradually as time went by, this culture was lost because the distance increased. Just like we see that even within a small region, the language changes. The Kannada that they speak here is different from the Kannada they speak in South Karnataka. Or the Marathi that is spoken here is different from the Marathi of Pune. And so on and so forth. So even with so much less distance, we see so much difference coming in. So gradually, as people expanded, especially after Parshuram's killing of the Kshatriyas, then the culture began to separate from the main Aryan culture. The languages began to evolve into some new languages, all originally based on Sanskrit. So therefore, what we are taught in history in our schools and colleges is a great myth. We are taught of the Aryan invasion theory. You may all remember in your school history books. We were taught that originally there is Mohenjo-Daro, Harappan civilization, and then the Aryans attacked, they invaded. They were superior class of people. The Indus Valley people were not so advanced. So the Aryan invasion theory is a complete falsity. Aryans have been originally living in this land, India, which is the original home of Aryan or Vedic culture. And there is no question of Aryans having invaded here. The Aryans in fact invaded from here. They went out from here and went out to different parts of the world. So because people do not have understanding of our Shastras, so all these wrong notions are being taught even in our schools. And today, nowadays, there are many historians also who are coming out very strongly protesting against this Aryan invasion theory. And they're coming up with many scholarly works to show that this is not true, that the Aryans were always living here. So in any case, simply because we are born in India doesn't automatically make us an Aryan. We have to follow the spiritual culture. Then we become Aryan. But today, most people born in India nowadays are giving up the Aryan culture. Simply by being called Arya Samaj, one does not become Arya Samaj. Arya Samaj should be one where the center is the Supreme Lord, not one that negates the form of the Lord. There are so many Samajas where they don't accept that God can have a form. So therefore, Arya means to understand the original personality of Godhead. So Krishna is saying, Anarya Jushtam, this is not becoming of you as an Aryan. As an Aryan, you should perform your duty according to Varnashrama. You are a Kshatriya, therefore you should know. And furthermore, such things will not help you to progress in your spiritual life. Aswargyam, it will not help you to get elevated to Swargaloka. Akirtikaram, and neither it will bring you fame in this world. It will bring you akirti, infamy. People will actually criticize you that here is a Kshatriya, Arjun, and instead of fighting, he is running away from the battlefield. So what will you gain? You will only gain the criticism and ridicule of the world. So therefore, my dear Arjun, rise. So what is going to be Krishna's next instruction to Arjun? That we will see in text 3. So kindly open text 3.
Klaibhyam asmagama partha naitatvayupapadyate kshudram hridaya daurbalyam tyaktvotishtha parantapa.
Translation: O son of Pritha, do not yield to this degrading importance. It does not become you. Give up such petty weakness of heart and arise, O chastiser of the enemy. Arjun has been addressed by Krishna by different names, and Krishna has been addressed by Arjun by different names. So do you remember some of the names by which Krishna has addressed Arjuna in the first chapter? Dhananjaya, one who gathered wealth for Yudhishthir. What else? Partha. Parth means the son of Pritha. That he is called here also. Anything else? Kapidhvajaha. Kapidhvajaha means one on whose chariot there is a flag of Kapi. Kapi means monkey, but not ordinary monkey. Here it refers to Hanuman. So Arjun has also been called as Kapidhvajaha. Now here he has been called as Parantapa. Para, others. Here it specifically refers to enemy. Tapa means one who chastises, one who can control, subdue. So Parantapa means one who has the capacity to defeat and subdue enemies. So Krishna is saying to Arjuna that you are Parantapa. You are well known as a subduer of foes, of enemies. And moreover, you are Partha, son of Pritha from Indra. You are personally the son of Indradev, the king of the Devas. Indra is well known for his victories in battle. You are born of pure Kshatriya blood. So how is it that you are talking like this? A Kshatriya was expected to personally punish any mischief mongers. If there was anybody who was creating disturbance in the kingdom, it was the king's duty to personally go out. There have been kings even as recently as 100 years ago, where they would go out into the kingdom, and if they caught even someone who was a thief, they would bring him and immediately personally punish him. This system was followed even till recently. King Parikshit, he also would go around, and the Bhagavatam we are told of how King Parikshit once came across a very cruel man who was about to kill a cow and a bull and to cut their legs. And Parikshit Maharaj immediately became ready to kill that man on the spot, because killing a cow, or killing any animal actually, is offensive, and killing a cow is most offensive. So Parikshit Maharaj was there and then willing to kill that particular man. Of course, that man surrendered to King Parikshit, and then King Parikshit had to forgive him and banish him from his kingdom. This man was none other than the age of Kali personified. It was personally Kali himself. The age of Kali was just about to come. This is Kali Yuga. So anyway, the king's duty is that when there is mischief mongers, then he is expected to go out and kill or perform acts of violence to protect the people. That is the meaning of Kshatriya. So therefore, capital punishment or killing is very, very important. When a king kills a criminal, he is actually doing a great favor to the criminal, because he is saving the criminal from going to hell. If that criminal was not punished now for that murder and not killed, then he would have to spend a very long time in hell. But because he suffers from, because he is put on the death penalty, so by that one, at that one stroke, the king has relieved the criminal of the visit to hell, and he has atoned for his sinful act of murder. So capital punishment nowadays is not done. The law today in India says that it is only to be done in the rarest of the rare cases. That is the judicial version. Capital punishment is to be performed only in the rarest of the rare cases. But this was not the case earlier. If somebody was found to be a murderer, he was immediately killed. And if a murderer is not killed by the king or the state on the plea of compassion, on the plea of mercy, then it is the king who will go to hell, because he has not performed his duty of punishing the criminal properly. Today we have come to such an age of contradictions, when if there is a murderer, or a very heinous murderer, then people are there, so many human rights organizations are there that appeal to the president for mercy. Because even if someone has been sentenced to death by the Supreme Court in our country, the president still has a chance to pardon him, the president of the country. So many of these human rights organizations, they appeal to the president for mercy. For whom? For all kinds of terrible murderers. Some years ago, I remember I read in the newspapers that there were two young men from Andhra Pradesh who blew up a whole bus. They wanted to hijack this bus because they wanted some ransom money or something like that. And then these two youths who were maybe in their late teens or early 20s, young but old enough to understand what is what, they were punished, and all the courts successively sentenced them to death punishment. Matter came up to the Supreme Court, and Supreme Court also upheld the verdict and said that yes, death punishment is valid for these two, because they have really killed in cold blood so many people. And then a host of human rights organizations in India, they all rushed with petitions to the Supreme, with the President and Supreme Court, pleading mercy, that we are a liberal society Now the times are different. We are not living in the dark ages. Now the times are modern. We must have compassion. They have suffered enough in the jail for so many years. So actually these people do not have spiritual understanding. This is a perfect example of compassion for the dress of the person. They simply want to save the body of that person. But what about the terrible sin that is there associated with that soul? That will cause this person to go to hell in the next life and suffer terribly for a long time. So these human rights activists, in the name of false compassion, they are going to do great harm to these two murderers and to the president himself. And the great contradiction is that these very same human rights organizations who are petitioning the president of India for mercy to horrible murderers, cold-blooded murderers of people, they never say one word for the 11 million helpless children in the womb who are slaughtered every year in the country. 11 million abortions are done every year in the country. 1 million legal, 10 million illegal. And the government, this is a government-sponsored program, government-encouraged program. How many of them are thinking that compassion should be applied here? That innocent child in the womb, unable to protect himself from the terrible instruments that will be inserted into the mother's womb to cut it and slaughter it into pieces. So these people have no compassion on these things for these helpless children. But for a murderer who has done such a heinous crime, they all rush in the name of being liberal and modern for mercy. Just see. Mercy, compassion. Till we understand what is the body, what is the soul, we are going to be confused. And everything is haywire now. For where compassion should be applied, they are not applying. And where compassion should not be applied, even in the interest of that person, they want to apply that false compassion. Not realizing that compassion is to kill those murderers. So they will be saved from going to hell. So therefore, here also we should realize, Krishna is chastising, he is scolding Arjuna. That now you should understand, Klaibhyam Masma Gamah Partha, how has this importance come upon you, O Arjuna? Klaibhyam means importance. As a Kshatriya, you are supposed to be very powerful, tejasvi, potent. How is it that you have suddenly become so weak? You have become so important like this, Klaibhyam? Klaibhyam Masma Gamah. You should not become like this, my dear Arjuna. Kshutram Hridaya Daurbalyam. Do not give way to weakness of heart. Hridaya Daurbalyam. The weakness of the heart. It is kshudram, it is very petty, it is condemned for a kshatriya to become weak like this in the face of battle. Of course, Arjuna is going to try to protest that I am doing this only not because I am afraid of battle, but because I do not want to kill my superiors. Arjuna is going to now present his logic again. He is going to continue from first chapter. But we can see that Arjuna's conception of compassion is not at all being approved by Krishna, the supreme authority. So there should be a standard reference for everything. Because all of us have different opinions about everything. You have one opinion about where to apply compassion. I may have another opinion. But what is the standard opinion of God? That should be our standard for reference. Should compassion be applied here or not? Arjuna wants to apply compassion, but Krishna doesn't approve. So he says, Hridaya Daurbalyam, this is not compassion, this is weakness of heart. When violence should be applied, to not apply in that case is actually violence. And that is lack of compassion. And when compassion should be applied and non-violence should be done, to apply violence, then that is violence. That is bad. So there is total confusion in the world in terms of understanding ethical principles of what is compassion and what is not, what is evil and what is not, simply because of lack of understanding of the basic concepts of soul and body. It is so simple. If someone would merely understand the Atma and the body and the philosophy of Sankhya Yoga as Krishna is propounding here in the second chapter, then it will be very easy for him or her to understand the way the things are going on. So Arjun
is in a state of confusion. But at least Arjun is intelligent enough to come to the perfect solution. He has come to the perfect master, Lord Krishna, the Jagat Guru, the Adi Guru, the Supreme Guru. But still, Arjun has not finished, and from next time, we will see text 4 onwards as to what are the other reasons that Arjuna is giving for not wanting to fight. In the first chapter, we saw that there are 4 reasons why Arjun refused to fight in the battle. Do you remember what are those 4 reasons? Anyone? What are the 4 reasons why Arjuna refused to fight? He gave so much logic. With anyone? First was compassion. He felt compassion for his relatives. Second, inability to enjoy the kingdom. He felt that if I kill all my relatives, then all the relatives will be dead and I will get the kingdom, but all alone, I will never be able to enjoy the kingdom. After all, you don't like to enjoy everything alone. You want to always share it and enjoy with someone. So he says, I will be unable to enjoy the kingdom even if I win and kill. Third point. Yes. If the elders are killed on the battlefield, Kula Dharma will be destroyed, irreligious practices will creep in, the women of the family will get polluted, unwanted children, Varna Sankara, will be produced, hellish situation will be created, Sankarau Narakayeva Kula Jnanam Kula Secha, and because of that, Patanti Pitaro Yesham Lupta Pindodaka Kriyaha. Then, when a hellish situation is created, the succeeding generations will not even perform religious activities like Pinda and Shraddha, and all the ancestors will fall down, all family and community welfare projects will be devastated, there will be total chaos in the family, irreligion will prevail, and humanity as a whole will fall down. That is another reason that Arjuna gave. And what is the fourth reason? Sin. He said, we will be overcome by sin because killing our worshipable elders is very sinful. Especially he's our gurus like Bhishma, Drona. So therefore it will be a great sin. I do not want to be a party to this sin. Arjun has conveniently forgotten that basically Krishna is asking him to fight. So where is the question of sin? In fact, going against Krishna's word is sin. This is the definition of sin. Sin means disobedience to the laws of God. But Arjun, although the father of Dharma, Krishna is standing in front of him, Arjun doesn't know what is sin and what is not sin. So these were the 4 reasons that Arjun gave in the first chapter. And there is still a 5th reason that we will see when we discuss text 4 onwards next time. So thank you very much for your kind attention. If you have any question, you may kindly ask till the darshan opens. And then if there are any remaining questions after that, we will continue.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna.
We should not have compassion for the body, but as today people do, they donate their eyes, they donate their bodies later on. So what is this?
No, it is not that we should not have compassion for the body. For example, if somebody is sick, it doesn't mean that you should not be compassionate upon him. But the point is that people think of compassion only in bodily terms. They think that this is everything. They have no understanding of the soul. They seem to forget that if you have one disease now and that is cured, tomorrow you will have another disease. So long as the material body is there, suffering will be there. So real compassion means to liberate the person from suffering altogether. And that is possible only if the person is relieved from the bodily concept of life. Then only you will be able to give that person real compassion. Real compassion means to give the person the greatest benefit. What is the greatest benefit? Complete permanent freedom from misery. So long as the body is there, we do need to look after it. We do need to help each other in regard to the body. That is all right, that is required. But without the spiritual vision, then it will be lost. Just like we very well understand that I am different from the car. I have a vehicle, I may look after the vehicle. So, because I understand I am different from the vehicle, I feed myself also nicely, I take care of myself nicely, but that doesn't mean I will not take care of the car. I will give the car petrol at the proper time, fill the air in the tires, do give for servicing. So same way, we should take care of the body appropriately as a vehicle, as required. But ultimately we should know, the real welfare work, real compassion means to uplift someone to the spiritual platform. So they can understand that I am not this body. And so long as I am associated with this body, suffering will continue. This is the real thing. So it should not be made to, we should not imagine that this spiritual conception is cruel, that we have no regard for the body, or if anybody is suffering for the body, we have no compassion. No, we should feel compassion. But the solution that we give should be based on spiritual understanding, not on material understanding only. So we will have darshan now, and if there are any questions afterwards, we will continue. And after that, there will be prasadam. Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Krishna prasadam and how to honor the prasadam. What is the correct way to honor Krishna prasadam for an initiated devotee? And is it possible to make an offense when you, if you don't honor it properly?
Yes, the proper word for prasad is not eat, but to honor. So devotees have their own particular language. So devotees don't say khana, khana khane ja rahe, don't say. We say prasad. So because it's prasad, it is not just simply eaten. It is honored. So it is called prasad seva, prasad sevan. So we honor the prasad. So when we take prasad, we should do it very devotionally with full faith that this is not different from the Lord. It is not ordinary food. Every morsel, every grain of this is spiritual, chinmay. Therefore we chant the prayer in the beginning of the prasad, Mahaprasade Govinde Nama Brahmani Vaishnave Svalpa Punyavatam Rajan Vishwaso Naiva Jayate. Which means that a person who has performed only very little pious activity cannot develop faith in the Lord, in His Mahaprasad and in His devotees. So if we consider this prasad to be ordinary food, then that is also considered an offense. So therefore prasadam should never be wasted. We should honor the prasad, take as much as we need, and then honor, worship Krishna in this way. So this is also one of the processes of devotional service. One of the limbs of bhakti is to honor prasad. See what a happy way of spiritual life. No austerities here. We just enjoy a nice prasad. Is there any other question?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
It is said in the Bhagavad Gita that one can be a devotee in an active state, passive state, conjugal lover as a parent. The last two are understood, but the starting first and second, active and passive state.
You see, we are. This refers to the five stages in which one can establish a relationship with Lord Krishna, God. Just as we have five relationships that we see here in this world, similarly, there are five relationships with God also that different souls can have. Now, the relationships that we find here in this world are actually the false relationships. They are only perverted reflections of the real relationship that exists between the soul and God. So those are the five relationships. The first is called passive, which means shantaras. Ras means the particular mellow, that relationship. Shantaras is a neutral relationship where one may just have some sense of awareness that God is great, but one doesn't involve an active seva. It is more or less neutral. One is completely on the spiritual platform, but the seva has not matured. Then there is active, where the seva has matured, But one still thinks of God as someone very great. God is great and I am his servant. He is my master, I am the servant. This is called Dasyaras. And then there is something called Sakhyaras, where the devotee feels that God is his friend, like the cowherd boys in Vrindavan would feel about Krishna. So that is Sakhyaras. They never considered Krishna to be God. And above that there is Vatsalyaras, where the devotee considers God to be his or her child. And the devotee loves God as a parent would love a child. Like Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda would love Krishna in Vrindavan. And then the conjugal state, where one can love God as a lover, like the gopis of Vrindavan did. This is considered the highest and most pure state of devotion to God that is ever possible. Ramya kachit upasana vrajavadhu vargena vakalpita. So that stage is very, very difficult to achieve and is considered the highest state of all devotion. So these are the five states in which any spirit soul could establish a relationship with God. Is there any other question? Yes, please.